drugs or ideas. What you consume influences who you become. On the Mind and Matter podcast, we learn together from the best scientists and thinkers alive today about how your mind-body reacts to what you feed it. Before starting Mind and Matter, I spent 10 years in academia doing scientific research. I got a PhD in neuroscience where I focused on neuroendocrinology and the neurobiology of behavior. And before that, I specialized in molecular, developmental, and evolutionary genetics. I use my scientific background to help parse and translate the information that guests share on the podcast. In addition to the podcast, I write long-form written content inspired by the show where I integrate what I've learned across episodes. I also have a free weekly newsletter where I provide you with upcoming guests, share links, and provide commentary on scientific studies and research that I'm reading, and more. Visit mindandmatter.substack.com to find all of my content. This episode is ad-free, and I rely on my audience to support my efforts. If you're getting value from this content, please consider becoming a paid subscriber to the Mind and Matter Substack. For just $5 a month, you'll get early access to episodes and other content, full episode transcripts, and I'll prioritize answering your questions in emails and the comments sections. You can also support me by checking out the links in the episode description to my affiliate partners, who make various health and wellness products that I use and enjoy myself. You'll receive a discount and help support the podcast that way. And if you want the benefits of a paid subscription, but it's not in your budget, simply sign up for my free weekly newsletter, send me an email, and I'll give you a complimentary paid subscription. Word of mouth is the best way to help the podcast grow. So if you like what I'm doing, please share your favorite episodes with family and friends. The purpose of the podcast is to provide you with information obtained largely from primary sources, the people doing the research and producing new knowledge. This content is never meant to serve as medical advice. And with that, enjoy the episode.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Can you give everyone just a brief overview of what you do and what your lab studies?
Yeah, it's a really interesting group of people that I work with. And we've sort of stumbled across a really interesting set of findings where we've uncovered that if you have different cellular stress responses, if you engage them the right way, they can increase lifespan and health span and improve a lot of different things. And that was very exciting. But the really cool thing is you only have to engage them in the nervous system. And once they're engaged there, the nervous system takes over and sort of coordinates this across the rest of the organism. And so for the last 20 years, we've been trying to figure out what that coordination is and what it looks like and who's doing the coordinating and, you know, evolutionarily, why would this evolve this way? You know, why doesn't every cell just set up its own stress response and its own ability to do this? Why does it have, you know, master cell types coordinate this?
Yeah. So the stress response, you know, in principle, you could imagine that each cell is almost like its own little island. It's going to age at its own rate. It's going to respond to whatever is happening right there to that cell. But on the other hand, you could also imagine that, you know, we are organisms with bodies. All of our cells have to be sort of aligned with a common interest in survival and reproduction. So maybe there are mechanisms that allow full body communication across cells that coordinate stress responses and things like that. Before we get into some of the details there, I want to talk a little bit about some of the basic cell biology, just to get people thinking about some of the organelles and stuff that I think we'll talk about. One very important organelle that many people have heard of and maybe understand, you know, a slice of what these things do is the mitochondria. Can you just talk a little bit about mitochondria, what they are and what they do, not only in terms of like what the average sort of biology student probably knows them for, but, you know, the expanded list of important things they do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So first off, I have to qualify that when I started my career, number one, I never thought I'd work in mitochondria. And number two, I never thought I'd be labeled as a neuroscientist. But, you know, it's, you just follow where the results send you. And we discovered mitochondria in this pathway and then it works in the nervous system. But to get your question, you know, mitochondria, I mean, we all, you know, we hate saying this as mitochondrial biologists, the powerhouse of the cell. That's what everyone recognizes them for, you know, the major energy producing organelle in your cell to produce ATP, ATP. But also they have a myriad of other functions. And when we think about that myriad of other functions, we need to actually go back and remember what mitochondria were. So, mitochondria were bacteria. And so billions of years ago, one bacteria made another bacterium. And somehow the bacterium that got engulfed figured out to give up most of its genome to its hosts and survive inside the host. And that happened, and it became a very symbiotic relationship. And that's how mitochondria evolved, is out of that symbiotic event that happened.
So one bacteria ate another bacteria, and somehow, I imagine we don't know exactly how this worked, but we know that the what became the mitochondria, that bacteria literally like gave some of its genes to the host cell, and sort of that was like the deal. That's how alignment was achieved.
Yeah, the deal, I think it had to be deals, plural. It had to happen over time, giving up, it didn't all at once give up 99% of its genome. It probably did it, over successive generations. But it's fascinating, it's probably the most important biological event that happened on planet Earth, is this ability of mitochondria to be endosymbiosed. And it was like, I would love to be able to go back in time and see how this event actually played out. Because it was probably tried many times and it was unsuccessful, but eventually it became successful for mitochondria. So in thinking about that, if you think about all the functions that a bacteria has, it has all of its other cellular functions, but also when it became a mitochondria, that was probably one of the first inner membranes inside of a cell. So of course, you had the plasma membrane, but now you had an internal membrane structure. And so a lot of the cellular reactions that were happening inside of the pre-eukaryote before it got a mitochondria was happening in three-dimensional space. But now you have a membrane to land on. Now you can reduce those reactions down to two dimensions because you can land on that surface and just control X and Y coordinates. And so that probably like massively accelerated evolution. You made reactions much more easier to attain. And so that allowed mitochondria to take on not just producing energy for the cell, but I mean, cholesterol synthesis happens there, iron biosynthesis happens. There's so many functions that mitochondria do. I mean, one of the major ones that we all know about is cell death. It organizes the death of a cell, is that when things get really bad, the mitochondria recognize it first and send out a signal to actually kill the cell. Is that actually an evolutionary thing from when it was a bacteria? Who knows? But there are all these things that mitochondria retained and gained as well when they became inside of the eukaryote. And so I'm always just amazed, we'll talk about some of the things that we've discovered that I'm still just sort of scratching my head saying, these mitochondria, they were put inside of cells billions of years ago. They gave up most of their genome, but they retained 13 genes, a couple tRNAs. And yet they have so much control over the cell, but everyone's like, no, it's the nucleus, it's nucleus, nucleus. But actually, the mitochondria are pretty darn important and actually drive a lot of cellular processes.
And are they in every single cell of a multicellular animal like us?
Yeah, except for, red blood cells that get rid of all their organelles.
I see.
But yeah, no, absolutely. And this is also the most fascinating thing as well, is that a mitochondria in your muscle cell looks very different than a mitochondria in your brain cell. So they've adapted, they're adaptable to be whatever environment they're going to be in. They change their structure, they change their functions. It's almost like these little aliens that are inside of us in every single cell, except for, of course, the red blood cells.
Yeah, I mean, and it is puzzling in one sense that you would see that much plasticity in something that has so few genes of its own. But I guess a lot of that is probably just coming from coordination back and forth with the nuclear genome.
Exactly. I mean, that is what everyone's beginning to realize, is that, people always thought the mitochondria were their own entities, functioning in the cytoplasm. But there's this massive communication that is these checkpoints going back and forth between the nucleus and the mitochondria. And definitely all of the stuff with the, changing form and function in a cell type specific manner is definitely coordinated by the nucleus, depending upon which energy status is required by the cell. What signaling events are happening, what state the cell's in, what age the cell is in. I mean, it's I'm totally fascinated by mitochondria.
Another, I mean, mitochondria, just in the past few years, it seems, they're becoming a hot topic. They're becoming way more famous than they used to be, I think, when I was first a student. So we'll come back to mitochondria. Another organelle that's really interesting that I know far less about, that I think is just talked about less, is the endoplasmic reticulum, which we could just abbreviate to ER. What is the ER, and what would be a very basic overview of what that part of a cell is doing?
Yeah, so in your cell, you're going to make new proteins, and the ones that are going to go outside of the cell, to make the plasma, the proteins on the outside on the plasma membrane, or be secreted to talk to other cells, all have to go through this structure, the endoplasmic reticulum. And it's sort of like the first processing center to know where to actually stick those proteins. Are they going to stay in some organelles inside the cell, or are they going to go actually outside? So the ER is like the first processing center at the Amazon, the big center where they sort out all the different orders. That's probably the way to think about the ER. It also has a really interesting evolutionary history. It's mainly wrapped around the nucleus. It also extends out into the cytoplasm as well, and it's actually evolved to contact mitochondria and actually control mitochondrial functions. And so, if you think about the nucleus, the ER, and the plasmic reticulum, and the mitochondria, they're sort of working in concert to create some form of homeostasis on energy production, protein production, and whether or not which genes you're going to transcribe. So it's an interesting little trio that's working together.
So there's a lot of proteins that get made within a cell that actually get shipped out to the plasma membrane of that cell, or just shipped out completely to go elsewhere to other cells, or to get into the bloodstream or whatever. There is some processing that has to happen before they can do that. The ER seems to be an important place for that. Can you give us a sense of, like, what do we mean by processing there? What's happening to the proteins? What needs to happen to them before they can be shipped to the final destination?
Yeah, so I mean, the very first thing is they have to be imported into the endoplasmic reticulum. And there they take on different folding states to determine if they're good enough, if the cell made them good enough to send on to get further process in other organelles, such as the Golgi, to get decorated. So this is the beginning steps of, we think of proteins as just the line of amino acids. But actually, what happens to the cells is that line of amino acids actually gets modified in many different ways. And in the secretory process, the getting proteins out of the cell, they get decorated with sugars or glycosyl groups. And there's a vast array of enzymes that do this. And I don't know enough about it, but there's a whole set of enzymes that put on different decorations that can signal different things to the outside of the cell. Sorry about that. They signal different things to the outside of the cell and actually protect these proteins from the bad things that are on the outside of the cell, proteases and things of that nature. So there's a whole bunch of modifications that actually occur.
I see. So when our cells make proteins, they're using DNA to ultimately make a sequence of amino acids, but that sequence of amino acids gets folded into a higher order structure that may or may not go perfectly. So there's quality control checkpoints built into this whole process to make sure the folding happens properly before these proteins, at least some of them, get decorated with sugars and other things. And the reason they have all of these sugars and other things sort of stapled or stitched to the outside of them has to do with things probably like their I would imagine that helps the cell know where to ship these things. It affects their longevity out in the environment, how stable they are, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then it also does structural things as well. So when they get to the outside of the cell, they actually serve structural properties. There's massive sugar moieties that are added to proteins on the outside of the cell. They're enormous. Hyaluronic acid is one of them. And it creates, a several nanometer long fibers that actually decorate the outside of the cell, which are thought, to protect cells from invasion from pathogens, bacteria or viruses. So, I mean, the ER is a really important structure, and over a third of the different proteins that are made actually go through the ER.
You
So it's
said about a third?
about a third, yeah.
And so what's the is the key difference there, whether they go through or not, what you said before related to whether or not they're going to be modified in order to be shipped outside the cell?
No, the first decision's made when the message is in the cytoplasm and it's beginning to be translated, and if it has the right beginning amino acids, it partners with a molecule called SRP, signal recognition particle, that drags it to the ER and says, "Oh, you have the right zip code. I'm going to put you into the ER. Now you're going to finish the rest of your translation and actually be inserted into the ER."
And so we talked about protein synthesis. The proteins can be modified with sugars. So this is kind of one interesting part of cell biology where our proteins and sugars are interacting. What about lipids themselves? So one thing I don't understand fully is obviously the cell membrane is made out of lipids. It's made out of fat molecules. Fats are, they're components of other things as well. But where in the cell are lipids being synthesized and packaged and made and distributed? Like, how does the cell, there must be a mechanism or mechanisms in place for it to construct its membrane and maintain its membrane. What is happening there?
I mean, that is also a major function of the ER is, whether or not you're going to make a lipid droplet that's going to stay inside of the cell and be an energy source and a structural source for membranes, for other cellular membranes, or if the lipid droplet actually stays inside of the ER, it becomes a chylomicron micron that gets secreted out. And so, you think about HDLs and LDLs, these lipid particles that we associate with hypercholesterolemia. That's actually beginning in your ER, making those chylomicrons.
I see. So they're made in the cell. The ER is involved in the production of those things, and then they're secreted out.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay, so we'll sort of keep some of those things in mind. I think we'll probably come back to the mitochondria and the ER in different ways. You've studied aging, the cell biology of aging. Before we sort of get into the discussion around aging, I want to ask you a vague question that I've asked many other researchers who study aging in all sorts of different ways. What exactly is aging from your perspective as a cell biologist?
That's a really interesting question. I actually just taught a class to our graduate students here yesterday about aging. And I sort of view it, I actually we can all recognize what aging is. We all see it. We're all experts on it. We're all own internal experts on what aging is. But none of us really know what it is. And I've been studying it now for over 20 years. And I'm not sure I know what aging is. I can recognize it, I can see it. And my best guess of what the process of aging actually is, it's how well you built your system. Is that, how well you put everything together until your time of reproduction. You're sitting there maintaining, you're building, and then you're maintaining the structure. And once you're past reproduction, aging is really the rate at which that is probably falling apart. And of course, there's things that you can do to keep it from falling apart faster, diet, exercise, sleeping well, which we just talked about, I think are the three major things that we can do to help slow that decline. But I'm really under the feeling that it's really about how you build your system. And, as humans, we've built our system pretty good. We're in utero for 9 months, and then it takes us a very long time to go through development, after birth to make a fully functional human. And so maybe that's why we live so much longer, is that we've just built the system exceptionally well.
And I would imagine, so when we think about aging too, we already talked a little bit about how, with the ER, there's this, there are quality control mechanisms, right? So cells are doing all sorts of things. There's a bajillion different mechanisms to do all of the things that all of our cells are always doing. But some of these mechanisms are specifically about making sure things are going right, making sure the proteins are made right. And so I would imagine there are certain parts of cell biology, certain mechanisms that play an outsized role in things like aging, because if they break, a bunch of other things that they regulate then start breaking.
Right. Yeah, I mean it's you know, I love working on these quality control pathways because they're there ensuring the integrity of an entire system. So, you know, we work on a quality control pathway for the mitochondria called the unfolded protein response. And its sole job is to monitor how well the mitochondria is functioning. And the mitochondria, you know, it's like 2,000 different proteins, a bunch of membranes, and you have one system that is sitting there monitoring the integrity of all of that. And so you're boiling down 2,000 components to setting it as just one, the stress response system. And it goes down with age. It actually goes down right when reproduction stops. And so, you know, figuring out ways to trick it to get back going again. You know, we've done this and several other people have done this. It actually is very beneficial. It's, you know, it's not the end all be all, but it makes the mitochondria function better, makes them last longer, makes them do the things they're supposed to do longer and better. But does it cause like 100% increase in lifespan? No. But it definitely, you know, increases a little bit and actually delays things significantly. It's not, you know, there's probably other pathways that are required for other parts of the cell. We're only just fixing one part, that's the mitochondria.
So there's somehow some of these mechanisms are tied to reproductive viability.
Yes.
And that makes intuitive sense, right? Like ultimately the purpose of living things, I mean, in some sense, you could argue that the definition of a living thing is that it's a you know, a biological entity subject to you know, Darwinian evolution. That's how a lot of people think about it anyway. And so obviously the currency there is going to be reproductive success. Obviously, there's lots of clear examples in nature where, you know, when you're done reproducing, the organism's done. Lots of insects operate that way. You know, salmon operate that way. And then obviously, there's a window in which organisms, such as ourselves and many other things, you know, they are reproductively viable. And that window eventually closes one way or another. But in what sense is reproductive viability tied to aging? And so, what I mean by that is it, So let's imagine two individuals in a population. They both reach reproductive maturity at the same time. Then one of them engages in, you know, say several rounds of reproduction. One of them does not. So they're both developmentally at the same stage at the same time, but one of them is engaging in reproductive acts and one of them isn't. All other things being equal, would that affect the rate of aging?
Oh man, you're opening a huge can of worms. So there's this classic paper, Nature paper. Let me think about the date. Probably 99, I want to say 98, 99. And the title of it, Barren Aristocrats Live Longer. And so they did a retroactive study looking at aristocratic women that gave birth versus didn't. And so they were trying to control that, you know,
When? Where and when was this?
this is like the 16, 17, 1800s.
Okay.
And so they're trying to control for environment as best they can by only looking at the aristocrats. You know, they're living you know, the best life possible at that time. And they look at the women there that gave birth versus the women that didn't. And the ones that didn't give birth outlive the ones that did. So it's a fascinating study. What it means, and has it been revisited, you know, in modern days? I don't know if it has or not, but it's a fascinating study that, you know, I think there is a lot of costs, especially to women, for childbearing. It seems like there's a lot of energy, stress, you know, the other things are happening to the body that would, you know, obviously shorten their lifespan. So you could argue that that's why the barren aristocrats live longer.
I see. And it's at least intuitive to imagine that in a sexually reproducing species like humans, there could be very large sex differences here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the problem is, you know, men traditionally live shorter than women because of other, you know, testosterone is a pretty potent anti-aging at certain levels. It makes us do stupid things.
Wait, did you say testosterone has anti-aging effects?
No, I'm saying that, you know, as a joke, you know, it's
Oh.
as a, you know, as a
It's anti,
15
I
year
see.
old. Yeah. When you're 15 years old and all of a sudden you get flushed with a lot of testosterone. You know, if the first time you do some pretty crazy things that shorten your lifespan.
So anyways, going back to sort of the cell biology of aging, I want to talk about this question that you've studied that I, you know, I've done a number of episodes on aging, but I've never talked about this piece, which is the coordination of aging across the cells in an individual body. So to what extent, I'll just start out with a very basic question. So to what extent are each of the cells in my body independently aging, and to what extent are they being coordinated somehow?
So, I mean, they're definitely being coordinated, and, you know, we are not the first ever. I mean, insulin is probably the best coordinator there is to coordinate your glucose levels inside of your cells and outside of your cells. So this has been known forever that, you know, there are central coordinators of these types of things, but to actually identify an aging pathway that itself coordinates across the entire organism, that's the one thing that we discovered. And that, you know, that stemmed out of this mitochondrial work where we were looking at earlier on when I worked with Cynthia Kenyon, you know, she discovered, and her and Gary Rufkin, that reduced insulin IGF-1 signaling makes animals live long. So there's this pathway of modulating IGF signaling growth control that's going to really factor into aging. And when I joined Cynthia's lab, I was very keen to know if that was the only pathway that could control aging. And so I went through and inactivated every single gene in this organism's body. And the vast majority of genes I uncovered were mitochondrial components, which I'd never thought about mitochondria, never, you know, thought I'd be working on it. But over and over again, our lab, Gary Rufkin's lab, many other labs uncovered the same genes that when you inactivated, reduced mitochondrial function and made animals live long. And that was peculiar. But then the thing that was most peculiar is, you touched on this earlier, every single cell has mitochondria. And so, and when we did our experiments, we were reducing mitochondrial function in every single cell. It's like, okay.
What exactly does that mean, reduce mitochondrial function?
Oh, so we were knocking down different nuclear encoded components of the mitochondria, of the electron transport chain genes. So we were reducing their function. So by and large, we're reducing mitochondrial function. And you could argue, well, which functions? Well, I mean, we know the electron transport chain functions, but many other functions were affected as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this point about every cell having mitochondria, when we did the experiments, we were knocking these down in every single cell and seeing this great effect, this great increase in longevity. And I don't know why we did it. Well, I mean, it was sort of like a curiosity in the beginning. As when I started my own lab, we're like, well, are all mitochondria equal and contributing to the aging process? Because at the time, the reactive oxygen species theory of aging was very popular, and all mitochondria contribute to aging, and they're all giving their quanta to the aging process. And I said, well, is that really true? And so what we did is we went and we knocked down mitochondrial function in certain cell types, you know, not every single cell, but just a few cells at different times. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating, is that most cells, it didn't register an effect. If anything, it made the animals live shorter. Mm. But there was one cell type, if we knocked it down on the nervous system, we recapitulated everything we did when we knocked it down on all the cells.
I see. So if you knock down mitochondrial function across the board, every cell, you get this longevity effect. The animals live longer. If you do that specifically in the nervous system, you get the same effect. Is that in all neurons? Is it in a different cell type? Is it in certain neurons?
No, that's a great question. So when we first reported, we did in all cell types, and we figured out that what these neurons are doing is that they're sensing mitochondrial stress and they're sending out a signal to coordinate it with the rest of the organism. And hopefully we'll talk about why that happens. But we started to ask questions like, which neurons are the responsible ones? And it really seems to be the serotonergic and the sensory neurons that are really playing a role in this. Mm. You can do other neurons. It doesn't matter. It's mainly those sets of neurons that are doing this. And then further work in other groups did this in mice. And it's really in the, you know, those neurons that control feeding, the POMC, AGRP, and the hypothalamus.
I see.
Do the same experiments and they get this response turned on and it goes out in the periphery. So it's definitely conserved. Up to mice. We don't know about in humans yet, but it is the serotonergic and the sensory neurons that are doing this. And they set up this beautiful system, communicate with the rest of the organism to turn on the stress response. And what it does is it protects the animal from future stresses. Mm. So it's like an ectopic way of tricking the system, is that you just touch the neurons and then they relay the information to the rest of the organism and set up this really beneficial effect.
When these neurons are sensing mitochondrial stress elsewhere in the body under naturalistic conditions, how is that happening? How are they actually sensing the stress? What is the signal there?
Yeah, so that is a really, so we've done it with brute force genetic approaches. You know, mainly what we do is we cause protein misfolding stress in the mitochondria. So John Hoogenrad discovered this in 2002, is that if you put misfolded proteins in the mitochondria, what happens is a signal gets sent to the nucleus to turn on the stress response pathway to come back and fix that challenge. And so we took advantage of John's discoveries and, you know, we started making misfolding stress in the mitochondria. So you can do that in many different ways, put misfolded proteins in there, or there's big protein complexes, the electron transport chain. You can mess up the stoichiometry there and get that up and running, you know, get that to do it. You can mess with the mitochondrial ribosome. So you change the synthesis of proteins in there and that causes stoichiometric imbalances. So there's a lot of different ways that we can get this thing up and running, get this stress response turned on.
Mm-hmm. And then that stress response, so that stress response gets turned on, somehow that's detected centrally. So how do the neurons know that the stress response has been turned on in some other cell?
So, well, that we don't know yet.
Mm.
So all we know right now is that if we turn it on the neurons can talk to everybody. If we turn on other cell types, those cell types don't talk to each other. And no one yet talks back to the neurons. So it seems to be a one-way street so far. I'm not ruling out that there's not these other forms of communication. We haven't uncovered them yet in our studies. And it's probably because we're limited in the way that we're looking at it. But right now, it seems like the stress has to be registered in the neurons. The neurons and the glial cells, we can talk about that, but the neurons and the glial cells register it, and then they coordinate it across the rest of the organism.
And when, so you said like there's this involvement of these sensory neurons and these serotonergic neurons. Do we have any sense for why it's serotonergic neurons as opposed to some other type?
Yeah, so that's a really, well, okay, so we can talk a lot about why this is originating. First, I mean, a major question is, why is it originating in the nervous system?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why can't every cell just determine for themselves? Why is there a master coordinator? And the nervous system seems logical, right? Because that's what the nervous system is supposed to do. It's supposed to sense the environment and then create homeostasis internally. That's its major job. And so that makes sense. That's exactly what we're seeing. And why is it the sensory neurons and the serotonergic neurons? Well, serotonin is, you know, it is a communicator of stress. And so it makes sense that those types of neurons would actually be the sentinels that get this response up and running. And if we knock out serotonin synthesis, we can't get this going at all. So serotonin is essential for getting this whole thing going, as long as there's also a hormone that's required as well, which is it's called a Wnt ligand. And it looks like it's also going to be conserved, at least its functions conserved in mice and probably humans. It's GDF15 or FGF21 is also a mitokine. That's what these things are called, is that when cells are stressed, especially neurons, they will release these hormones to register with the rest of the body so that, you know, it's a central locator. It's like, oh, my neurons are stressed out. Let's prepare the periphery for this impending stress that's going to happen. And so then that gets to the next question is, you know, these sensory neurons, what are they actually sensing? And so we do know that pathogens, so we're going back to remember, mitochondria are ancestral bacteria.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you give a pathogenic bacteria to an animal, it will turn on this stress response.
Yeah.
Because the mitochondria are like, oh my God, there's somebody like me in the environment that's trying to attack me. That's pathogenic bacteria. Let's protect ourselves. And so that's fascinating. But why sensory neurons? And so we've done this experiment where if we just have animals smell the pathogen, They're not being infected. They're not eating it. They're not touching it. They're just smelling it. They register that pathogen and then they turn on this response in their neurons and they communicate it to the periphery, just like all of our genetic experiments.
So it's like a
And now
preemptive, it's a preemptive response.
it's a preempt. So then if you take those animals that have smelt the pathogenic bacteria and now expose them to the pathogen, have them infected, they're more resistant than the ones that didn't smell it.
And what kind of animals are you talking about for these particular experiments?
So this is all in C. elegans and the nematode C. elegans so far that we're
Okay.
bringing able to this in.
So
We're trying to do the mouse. What's that?
little worms that can smell the bacteria.
Yeah, little
Okay.
worms that can smell the bacteria. And it's only pathogenic. If they smell non-pathogenic bacteria, it doesn't matter. It's only pathogenic.
I see. So these mechanisms can they're not merely reactive mechanisms. They're not, it's not like you need a stressor inside of you doing the stress. They can preemptively respond based on the sensory detection of a stressor that could get into the body
Yes.
and protect you, preemptively protect the body, if that actually does happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's you can tell. I don't know if you and I've never met, but my voice right now is I'm suffering from a little bit of a cold, and I'm like, this system that we have where we let the pathogen into our body, then all of a sudden we react to it, do an innate immune response to it, and then do an adaptive response to it. I'm like, that. Why don't we have something that's more clever that detects it in the environment before it even infects us? And so that's where a lot of our research is going, is that we're seeing that the stress response pathways are registered in sensory neurons first, and then they communicate it to the rest of the body. And so what in the environment are they actually registering? And this first set of experiments, this first set of papers that are coming out where they're registering pathogenic bacteria, I think is fascinating. Because wouldn't you want to know about a pathogen before it infects you, be a little bit more resistant to it? So now we're trying to, of course, see if this is conserved in the vertebrates and figure out what the smell is. I mean, I think the most fascinating idea is if we can figure out what the smell that this pathogen's putting off, could we actually just make a perfume and put that in the environment? And make people more resistant to future pathogenic attacks.
And when some of these stress response mechanisms turn on that protect the organism, what is that? What's happening at the cellular level? What's happening that's doing the protecting?
Yeah, so we see that they turn on this mitochondrial stress response, but inside the cell, what happens is we see the mitochondria divide, so they fizz away from each other into small bundles. And I don't know exactly why that's a protective mechanism. Some people say that that's a way to allocate resources into smaller packets. Your defense mechanism is to divide and make yourself smaller so that there's less opportunities to get, destroy one giant mitochondria. If the pathogen is successful, it may just destroy one small piece of a mitochondria, not all of them. So it divides the mitochondria. The other fascinating thing that we're finding, so we're going to put another layer on top of this smelling pathogens. So if the animal is pregnant, it smells a pathogen and then its progeny. So we take the pathogen away, the smell of the pathogen away,
So
and that
it only smells that it's never infected.
it's never infected, it just smells it. Let's smell it for a day or so, and then we let the animal reproduce and lay its and have its progeny. Those progeny have now turned on that stress response. And those progeny, if you now expose them to the pathogen, are now resistant to the pathogen. So there's a wiring that's happening between the nervous system and the germline that's preparing the future generation that, hey, we came across a pathogen. It's more than likely that you're being born into a pathogenic environment. Let me set you up so that you can survive a little bit longer to make it to reproduction.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah.
And
Is there
then,
any?
so one final layer is that if you get rid of the germline, so these animals are sterile, they have no germline. If they smell the pathogen, they can't turn on the response in the periphery
In their own body.
in their own body because there has to be the impetus that, hey, I'm going to reproduce, let's protect the body. But if there's no germline there, there's no point in actually setting it all up.
I mean, it actually makes sense when I stop to think about it because of, from a Darwinian perspective, right, the whole purpose of mitigating stress and surviving at all is to reproduce. And so it makes sense there'd be something hooked up from the germline into these systems.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it makes sense to you. It was kind of a head scratch. We were like, wow, this is really cool. And I mean, the editors loved it as well. It's like, oh, this is actually pretty fascinating. This is happening.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you could imagine, right? That there's obviously it would be possible to hook it up differently. It's not like you could, right? It's perfectly, it's easy to imagine how you could have a stress response that's not literally hooked up to the presence of the germline. But still, that's an elegant way to really tie the end goal to these things.
Well, and also if you're thinking about mitochondria, right, this is a mitochondrial stress response. You're detecting the pathogen, you're protecting the mitochondria in the progeny, and you have to have that germline in order to get the whole thing up and running. So there are the one cell type that cares the most about your mitochondria is your germline. So when you think, when you're making your germ cells, you start out with 40,000 mitochondria. And then you eventually select it down to 40 to put into that germ cell, into the oocyte. That's where all of your mitochondria come from. And it's the 40 best, most pristine, you know, the best Maserati, Ferrari, whatever you want to mm-hmm. use, the best mitochondria. The rest gets selected out.
I see. So there's some kind of selection mechanism there where the developing oocyte can determine the quality of the mitochondria and then filter away the bad ones.
Yep. Yeah. And that is... If it didn't, you know, your fidelity would go down dramatically over generations if you weren't able to reset, you know, the germline's immortal.
Yep.
And so it has to have the best of everything. And mitochondria is one of the major things it has to have. And if it didn't do that, you know, you may lose a minute per generation. And over a successive generation, the lifespan of the organism is gone if it couldn't do this. And so coordinating this with your sensory input from, you know, from the nervous system to now the germline. I mean, this is like the greatest time of my career. I mean, it's the things that the lab is discovering and the way they're doing it. It's just truly fascinating what they're doing. And every day I'm like, oh, wait, that works that way. And it's like, oh my gosh, wow. Really fascinating biology.
So you mentioned mitochondrial fission. And again, I don't know a terrible amount about mitochondrial biology, but my understanding is that the number and the size of mitochondria are important features within a cell. They tell you a lot about how old the cell is, how well it's functioning. At a high level, what is the size of the mitochondria and the number of mitochondria per cell generally tell us? Are those like good correlates of an animal's age, of its ability to produce energy and so forth?
Yeah, I mean... The mitochondrial morphology is a metric, but it's not clear the general theme is that if mitochondria break apart, the mitochondria aren't functioning as well. If they're fused together into a nice network, they're functioning better. But you can break those correlations all the time. So it's really like, you know, the dynamics is really, there is a lot of dynamics that happen with mitochondria, but it's not always accurate. And so it's, you know, we don't put a lot, you know, we're fascinated to see the dynamics happen, but I don't really understand entirely that it's always correlative to better mitochondria versus not better mitochondria. Now, the number of mitochondria, that is a fascinating one, is that, you know, some cells can have 1,000 mitochondria. Some cells can only have 3 mitochondria. And I mean, different cell types. I'm not saying the same cells. I want to clarify that, you know, within, you know, a certain cell type, that cell type will always have 1,000, and the other cell type, the others will always have 3. Now, that's a fascinating metric, is like, how does a cell determine this? What is the counting mechanism? How is it known? And that is wide open space that's out there. But there is one idea out there that no matter what, mitochondria are in excess no matter what cell type it is. So with 1,000, you're like, okay, yeah, of course it's in excess. But the one that only has 3, actually, the bioenergetics really suggests that it maybe only needed 1. And so we have this excess of mitochondria. And that's, you know, 10 years ago, people were like, we need more mitochondria. To have health, we have to increase mitochondria. We have to upregulate this gene called PGC1 alpha that is required to make more mitochondria. We need to target that and make more mitochondria. You know, we have a mitochondrial disease, let's just make more mitochondria. That's not actually turning out to be right, is that mitochondria are in excess. And the results that we have where we knock down mitochondrial function and actually get better health goes against all of that. Because it's triggering the stress response, right? It's triggering this response to make the mitochondria
And naively, I would think too that more mitochondria, you know, on the one hand, you might think, oh, more ATP, more resources. But on the other hand, more oxidative stress, more reactive oxygen species.
More oxidative stress, more volume taken up inside the cell. I mean, there's lots of reasons. You know, it's kind of one of these things, like when your car starts to break down, you go, you know, it's like, do you go buy more cars? It's like, no, you fix your car. You know, I'd rather have one really good functioning car than 10 sort of broken cars. And so making more mitochondria is, I think, is not the way to go. It's actually making your mitochondria better.
And how do you guys measure that in cells? What does better mean in terms of mitochondrial function?
I mean, we go down, we look exactly at mitochondrial function. So we look at how well they're producing ATP, how well they're utilizing oxygen, you know, how well they're doing other enzymatic activities that are happening inside of the mitochondria is one of the major drivers. You know, how well, you know, mitochondria have this amazing ability to pump protons across the membrane. Mm-hmm. They create this gradient to produce ATP. So just looking at that is one of the major things, is can they actually create a gradient?
And in these sensory and serotonergic neurons, these sort of special neurons involved in this whole stress response stuff, what are the mitochondria doing in those cells? Are they behaving differently? Do those cells have weird mitochondria in some way?
Oh, man. Yeah, this is going to be like the rest of my career. so we really want to know why those mitochondria are more sensitive than mitochondria and dopaminergic neurons, or mitochondria and other, you know, glutamatergic neurons. You know, what's the difference? And that's something that we are that's like a major goal in our lab, is trying to figure this out. You know, there's one idea that the mitochondria are different. The other idea is that the stress response is dialed differently in those cells. And that those cells, you know, they're like the canary in the coal mine. Like that stress response can be triggered, you know, just with very little change, and turn this response on. So there's two possibilities that are happening there that we're actively trying to figure out. And I don't have an answer for. I wish I had an answer, but I don't.
In terms of some stress response mechanisms that cells use to protect themselves, we talked about this unfolded protein response. There's also something that I know some about, but not too much, which is the heat shock response. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the heat shock response and just the general ability of cells to respond to temperature differences from what's optimal?
Yeah. So the heat shock response is probably one of the most evolutionarily ancient stress responses there are, you know, stemming way back from bacteria, sigma factor, sigma 25, turning on the heat shock response, conserved all the way, you know, into humans. And, you know, it's sort of thought that heat shock response, you know, we talked about the mitochondrial stress response, the ER response. The heat shock response is sort of, is thought to monitor what's happening in the cytoplasm, you know, not in the other organelles, you know, all the other stuff. It's monitoring what's happening there. And it's a transcriptional response that when there is a stress to the cytoplasm, it turns on a bunch of repair enzymes and chaperones to come and refold that stress that's happening in the cytoplasm. Now, traditionally, it's called the heat shock response because it's turned on by elevated heat, which, if you remember your second law of thermodynamics, that's going to actually drive free energy and actually cause proteins to misfold. Mm-hmm. And so that's a major basis of why it's called the heat shock response. And you know, these chaperones get turned on to refold these misfolded proteins that turn this thing on. And let me think about, what was the rest of your question?
Yeah, more just about- just in you know, the heat shock response, but just in general, how cells buffer themselves against deviations from the temperatures they need to maintain themselves.
Ooh, yeah, that's a really, really good question. I mean, So it is thought that you are able, when you have the delta in change, going from a low temperature to a high temperature, this transcription factor, HSF1, can be released and turn on the stress response to cause this buffering of these chaperones to help refold the proteins that are happening.
But it sounded like what you were starting to say maybe was, we call this the heat shock response because that's the context in which it was first discovered, but it's not a heat shock response. It's a more general protective mechanism.
Yeah, its major response is the heat, but it also responds to other stresses as well. I mean, anything that really causes protein misfolding, it should be really a protein misfolding stress response that it's responding to, and it's thought to be primarily proteins that are in the cytoplasm that it's responding to.
And I would imagine that, at some point, so a cell detects stress, there's some misfolded proteins for whatever reason, some of these mechanisms turn on and they ensure that the proteins don't get misfolded, and then everything goes back to normal because the mechanisms worked, they protected the cell, and that's great. Sometimes I would imagine that the stress is just too much and things go completely haywire and the cell's no longer viable. Is that when we start thinking about things like autophagy?
Yeah, I think there's going to be layers of dealing with stress, is that when the challenge gets too great, there's going to be layers that happen. Turn on the heat shock response, try to acutely deal with it. If you can't deal with it, you're going to form protein aggregates, and those are going to be recognized by autophagy. Autophagy is going to try to catch up, deal with it, and then probably by that time it's caused so much stress inside of the cell that mitochondria are affected. And you're going to induce apoptosis and actually just kill the cell for the benefit of the entire organism.
Is there a link there between so you if you have misfolded proteins or you start getting these protein aggregates, the cell can then be autophagy can happen. You can get rid of that cell. That can be good if that cell can be replaced. But I would imagine the nervous system, it's a different story because you can't replace most of those neurons. Is there a connection here between mitochondrial health, autophagy, and like neurodegenerative diseases?
Oh, there's a, that is the major link is, we're finding, mo a lot of these neurodegenerative diseases are linked to defective mitochondria and defective autophagy. And so, or defective mitophagy, to get more specific, being able to get rid of mitochondria that are defective. You can do that through autophagy as well. And, many of the disease linked and many of the genes that are linked to Parkinson's are linked to autophagy machinery, lysosomes, mitochondria. Alzheimer's disease is becoming more prevalent that we're having defects and dealing with defective mitochondria, dealing with defective autophagy. And so, but it still gets down to the question is, in all those diseases, there's select neurons that are affected, not all the neurons in your brain are affected. And it's getting back to this question, it's like, well, why those ones? Why not these other ones? And I think that's a question that everyone would love to address.
So you have all of these stress response pathways that cells have. There are some of these very special cells that are involved in coordinating stress responses across all of the cells or many of the cells of an animal's body. I imagine too, there's also important differences in terms of how things play out when you distinguish between chronic stress versus acute stress. This is something that people talk about all the time. So, for example, people often describe, say, something like exercise as an acute stress, and because it's acute, it's generally good. It's generally beneficial for the organism. But if you were to apply stress chronically, it's generally bad for the organism overall. When we think about things like temperature and we think about acute stressors, are so like things that are becoming very popular right now. Everyone seems to be talking about ice baths. People take ice baths in the morning. They expose themselves to extremely cold water for just a short period of time, then they get out. In essence, what's going on with those types of acute stressors? Are you engaging some of these mechanisms in the body and thereby making them more stress resilient overall?
So I think one of, I mean, I don't know enough about the ice bath thing. Sounds horrible. I mean, it's, I mean, just getting up in the morning's hard enough. Why jump in an ice bath? It sounds like a good way to a heart attack, actually. But I mean, let's talk about a different acute stressor that a lot of people, I mean, I actually inadvertently do this a lot. It's like intermittent fasting, right? So, you eat 8 hours a day, another 16, you fast more or less. That definitely induces autophagy. And it's thought to be actually beneficial because it's inducing autophagy. And, Walter Longo has this great stuff, and the late Kevin Mitchell had some stuff on this about going to surgery. People normally glucose load you to get you through the surgery, like, oh, that's gonna be much better. And actually, they did the experiments. Actually, if they fast them before, you actually have a better survival rate coming out. And so, it's one of these acute stressors. This idea is that, yeah, you're actually acutely turning on autophagy to clear out any damage that's happening, so that when you come out of that stress, now you're in a better state. So I think, I love exercising. I love the end of the exercise, that it's over with, because I know that I stressed my body out and now it's time to recover, and it's actually going to be much better down the road for doing that.
And so when you do something like intermittent fasting or time restricted feeding, so you eat in, say, an 8 hour window and then you don't eat for 16 hours, autophagy starts to happen in that 16 hour window sometime after you stop eating. Can you give us a sense of how selective the autophagy is? Are there very specific cell types that get engulfed and digested, or is it
Yeah,
sort of across the board?
that is a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I could speculate that, probably the cells are they're the most nutrient sensing are the first to start inducing autophagy. So those are probably the very first ones to start inducing it, but I don't know which cells would do it. And there are people that do longer fasts as well, and whether or not that's going to be beneficial, I mean, it sounds miserable, but a little bit of stress in your life is good. What doesn't kill you will only make you stronger, I guess. But I think there's a limit to it. I think having too much stress would be really, really bad. And it's this thing, you alluded to, it's like chronic stress. I think that's got to be, way up there with one of the number one things that are causing a lot of diseases. I mean, we see this diabetes, depression, all these other things. I mean, it's
Has anyone done the experiment where, so presumably you want some level of autophagy, but not too much. You want to get rid of the damaged cells, the bad cells, the cancer cells. You obviously don't want to get rid of healthy cells. Have people done experiments where they just turn autophagy way down or turn it off? And if so, what generally happens?
Oh, I mean, what generally happens is that you can't survive starvation. So if you have an animal that has autophagy turned off and you remove food, they don't survive for very long. So it's definitely essential for that. I mean, it's definitely essential also for a developing animal as well. So once, if you can get them through development and then turn off autophagy, it's really not a good scenario. It's they can't survive, caloric fluctuations at all.
I see. So part of what the autophagy is doing is it's enabling the cell to, I mean, literally eat its own cells and use that in the absence of an external food source.
That's right. Yeah, it's your backup mechanism for generating resources when you're not consuming them.
So when we talk about so the nervous system in particular, and I think about mitochondria, naturally I think, mitochondria, I think energy, I think energy, I think about energy, highly demanding cell types like neurons, like muscles. Are there any major differences between neurons and muscle cells in terms of how they use mitochondria or what the mitochondria are doing beyond just raw ATP production?
Yeah, so I mean, in the neuron, it's fascinating is that, at the synapse where neurons are talking to other neurons, is, they have to release a lot of ions to create electrical currents to do that neural communication. And a lot of that, mitochondria are massive storages for calcium. And so calcium drives a lot of that. So at these synapses, you have a lot of mitochondria built up there. And there are waves that, waves that are happening of ATP release and calcium release, right, happening right there. And then in the muscle, the same thing, a similar thing is happening, is that with muscle contraction, of course you're going to need ATP to do that, but also you're going to have fluctuations of calcium coming in and out. And a lot of that is actually coming from mitochondria as well. And mitochondria and muscle, it's more localized to the sarcomere, you know, the structure of the muscle that's creating those contacts. But it's pretty fascinating that they're both there, not doing the traditionally their ATP thing, but more their calcium functions as well.
Interesting. And, you know, another interesting thing to think about in terms of mitochondria instead of neurons is neurons have a very interesting shape. Many of them are extremely long. I imagine the mitochondria have to physically move or even be transported to different parts. What do we know about mitochondrial movement within something like a neuron?
Yeah, this is not my area of expertise. So there's a great junior faculty at Duke, Chantelle Evans. This is her body of work that she's, you know, trying to figure out how these mitochondria get to the synapse, you know, how they traverse such a long period of time once they're there. And what if something goes bad with them? How do they actually get degraded? Because autophagy machinery is not there. So it's really fascinating, like, what's going to happen at the synapse with these mitochondria. And, you know, she's right on this question, trying to go after and figure it out. And I think it's, you know, it's a Pandora's box. There's going to be so many things that are going to be learned about how mitochondria are regulated in this very subcellular localized place. And like you said, these neurons, they can be huge. Mm-hmm. And how's the information carried from one part of the cell to the other is going to be fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is sort of a big and somewhat vague question, but I think anything you could say here would be interesting. In terms of dietary factors that lead to mitochondrial dysfunction, are there any types of diets or types of macromolecules when, you know, given in excess, say, or if you're deprived of certain nutrients, play an outsized role in driving mitochondrial dysfunction?
Oh, high fat diet, of course.
And can you get more specific there? Is particular fat?
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, I don't know the literature enough, like, you know, which lipid molecule is in excess, but I mean, mice on a high fat diet, I mean, their mitochondria look horrible. You know, you look at the liver, I mean, creating these large lipid droplets in the poor mitochondria are trying to survive. I mean, it's high fat diet is really toxic to mitochondria. Mm-hmm.
And do we understand why, like what the mechanisms are there?
Nope. I mean, I don't. Let's qualify that. Okay. I don't. I'm sure somebody out there has informed ideas and maybe data that says, you know, why high fat diet is so toxic to mitochondria.
But it's probably not super well worked out.
No.
Got it.
No.
So what are some of the things that you guys in your lab are working on today? What are some of the questions that you're asking right now that it looks like you're going to have exciting answers to, or that you think you're going to make progress on in the near future?
Yeah. So we've covered a lot of this, you know, this neuronal control of mitochondrial form and function in the periphery, you know, and then trying to figure out, you know, why the neurons are the ones registering this and what are they actually picking up on. That's a major place we're going, but there's a really just basic question. You know, we've talked a lot about these stress responses, and, you know, if we go back to your idea about the heat shock response, that it's monitoring misfolded proteins in the cytoplasm. How many misfolded proteins have to be monitored? Mm-hmm. You know, which misfolded? Is there certain ones that it monitors? You know, what is something as basic as that has not been answered? You know, with our mitochondrial defects that we see, and we turn this, you know, this mitochondrial stress, you know, let's say that there's a cell that has 1,000 mitochondria. Is it just one bad mitochondria? Or do all 1,000 have to be bad to get the response up and running? And it's, you know, it sounds like kind of a boring question, but it's actually fundamentally important because it's telling you a lot about this sensing mechanism and how it's actually registered and what it's actually responding to. You know, if you think about the heat shock response and say, well, it just monitors misfolded proteins. Well, most of the proteins in our cell are misfolded at one time or another, you know, when they're forming and when they're relaxing. I mean, very few of our proteins in our cell are actually that crystal structure that people show us. And so why isn't the heat shock response turned on all the time? Or is there something special that it's monitoring? You know, is it monitoring complexes, you know, such as the ribosome or, you know, the microtubules or the actin filaments, you know, major structures? Maybe that's what it's monitoring and trying to register. So we're trying to figure those questions out, you know, do very quantitative experiments of just dicing in a little bit of, you know, something bad to see how much is required to turn on those responses. Because, you know, if you start thinking about trying to drug these responses, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a bell-shaped curve, is that you're going to want a sweet spot more than likely. Because if you give too much stress, you're not going to be able to fix it and you're going to cause toxicity. And if you don't give enough stress, you won't get the response turned on. So somehow you have to figure out what that sweet spot is. And if you're trying to make a drug, that's probably, you know, people that make therapeutics and drugs, that's the worst place you want to be in, is trying to find a sweet spot for your therapeutic, because everyone's sweet spot may be a little bit different. We haven't talked, you know, the heterogeneity in the human population, your heat shock response may be slightly different than mine. But if we take the same dose of heat shock inducer, you may get a benefit and it may actually end up killing me if we're on the wrong spectrum. And so, you know, this has happened with diet restriction, you know, people on different spectra, and, you know, mice respond completely differently because they're on, you know, there's different sweet spots for different strains of mice.
So you said, you know, you're studying things like mitochondria in neurons today, but that's definitely not where you started. So did you start out as like, how did you get your start? Was it in some other aspect of cell biology?
Yeah. So I started out, so my history, my undergraduate, I got the opportunity to work in a lab. One of my heroes, Ardith McCracken, at the University of Nevada, Reno, and we were working on ER stress, her lab was, and it was really interesting is that this was in the early 90s, she was putting misfolded proteins into the ER and they were getting degraded. And she was like, well, what's the quality mechanism there that's monitoring this? And she found out that, you know, this thing called the ER unfolded protein, so the ER associated degradation, ERAD, this pathway that was discovered by her. And it was part of my undergraduate thesis. So I got really turned on to genetics and cell biology. And then I came to Berkeley to do my PhD and worked with Jasper Rhine. Completely changed, worked on DNA replication and transcriptional silencing and cell cycle stuff and yeast. And the topic was fascinating, but the education was more fascinating, is that Jasper trained me to be a classic geneticist, you know, to attack every question with a genetic point of view and, you know, try to go after it that way. So I got really rigorously trained in genetics. And armed with that, I wanted to go after a really big problem. You know, I wanted to work on schizophrenia, but it seemed a little bit too complex at the time. You know, it's 1 to 2% of the population, multigenic. I was like, oh, this would be great. But it seemed really complex. And so I said, oh, let's do something a little bit less complex. And that was right when Cynthia discovered DAF2, you know, a single gene profoundly influencing aging. I said, oh, wow, something as complex as aging can be boiled down to a single gene. I got to go work on that. So that's where I've always been a geneticist with a little bit of cell biology and a little bit of biochemistry involved, but I've always attacked the question from genetics. And like I said, when I started with Cynthia, I went looking for a new pathway because she was going to work on insulin IGF-1 signaling. That was clear. I had to find my own path. And, you know, I do this screen and I pull out all these mitochondrial genes. And one of my advisors, great colleague here at Berkeley, when I was deciding on being a postdoc, where I was going to do my training for postdoc after my PhD, I said, yeah, I'm going to go work on aging. And he said to me, that's boring. You're just going to be working on mitochondria and metabolism. I said, no. I'm going to find this new signaling pathway. It's going to be totally interesting. And so I find these mitochondrial genes and I write to him and tell him, he's like, well, your career is over with. You're done. It's boring. Now, there's nothing to work on. And so that's where I got in. And then when we found out the mitochondria are working in neurons, then all of a sudden I got labeled as a neuroscientist, which it's a fantastic group of people. I'm happy that they brought me into their group and they've taught me a lot. But I'm clearly not a neuroscientist. It just happened to work on a problem that happens to be in the nervous system. I'm trying to learn neuroscience every single day, and it's an upward, you know, as you get older, it gets harder to learn. So I'm trying to figure it out. So that's been sort of my path of how I ended up, you know, where I never planned on being here. it just the results, that's where it took me.
That first gene that you talked about, DAF2, I think it was called.
Yeah.
What was that gene doing?
So that is the insulin IGF-1 receptor.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so Cynthia's work, she was, when she transitioned over to work on aging in the nematode C. elegans, it goes into this alternative life cycle, this dour phase that can last. So normally the worm only lives about 3 weeks. But if it goes in this alternative phase, it can live 6 months and then come out and live a normal lifespan. And so she was reasoning that the genes that control that may actually be co-opted to control normal aging. And so all those genes have been discovered, the DAF genes. And she started looking at those in aging profiles. And she found that the DAF2 mutation that controls entry into this thing, into this diapause, is actually super long-lived. And it opened up, and then she actually figured out that it wasn't part of its diapause function. It actually had a normal function in aging, which was very profound. And now it's been carried forward in flies and mice, and there's correlative studies in humans as well as being a central regulator for aging.
So there's lots of results out there in different organisms that show that you can boost longevity. You can make animals live longer. How much longer in general can people make animals live? Are we talking about 1 or 2 or 10% increases, or do you sometimes see much more dramatic increases?
Yeah, you definitely see. So the mitochondrial genes that I told you about, when we knock them down, they're increasing by 100%.
And so, how long do those organisms live normally?
So normally the worm would live, let's say 25 days. Now it would live 60 days,
Okay, wow. So you're doubling its lifespan.
doubling its lifespan. And then if we combine, Cynthia's IGF-1 mutations with our mitochondrial perturbations, now we're looking at, 100-day lifespan. Tripling, quadrupling lifespan. And so
And
you can start, once we've, there's a couple major pathways that have come out of all these aging studies over the last 20 years. The IGF-1 pathway, the mitochondrial pathway, mTOR plays some role as well. And so if you put the three of those together, you can get massive lifespan extensions happening.
And when you see those massive extensions in these model organisms, is that are they just like aging slower every single day, or do they start aging later? Like, give us a sense for what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, so they are very healthy. They look like they are aging slower. Like the IGF-1 mutant animals, very robust, and then they start declining at a normal rate, just like wild type animals when wild type animals start declining. The mitochondrial ones are a little bit different. So when you first do it, the whole body one, the animals look horrible. I mean, when I first discovered this, when I was looking, I was like, these animals are dead. And then I'd shake them and they'd come back alive because they had ATP loss in their muscle, everything, but they were still alive. And that's how we found them. But then when we moved it just in the nervous system, it doesn't affect all that. So we don't have all that negative. They look like the IGF-1 mutant animals. They're moving along totally happy and looking really good. So when you combine the two of those, it really does look like everything's. So we see reproduction is delayed longer. A lot of things are thrown out till later in life, and then but they do. I mean, the most amazing thing in aging research that no one talks about is this stochastic decline that happens with lifespan. So let me rephrase that, is that if you take, a group of isogenic, identical animals growing on the exact same environment, exact same petri plate, after about 10 or 15 days, one dies, and then 30 days later, the last one dies. So they're identical.
Yeah. So they all sort
Genetically.
of tank at a different point for some reason.
And you can take this out to the human population. It's all every population that except for programmed death, in salmon and other things, they all have this like trailing curve of stochastic decline that no one can, say why. And they're identical animals. And you're like, you can't argue that they're in different environments. You can't argue that they're genetically different. What is going on here? And it's played out in heterogeneous populations as well. And that would be fascinating to learn, because if I'm that first one, I'd like to know, why can't I be that last one? Why can't we just square this curve off? And it's all, you know, February 23rd, 2080, I'm going to die, you know? Why can't it be that way? Why does it have to be this unpredictable curve happening at the end?
And that's just a mystery right now.
So there has been, funny enough, there has been some studies. I don't know if it explains the curve, but if you look earlier in life, so if you take our mitochondrial stress pathway, and we have ways to monitor it in vivo, we have a bunch of animals crawling around on a plate, totally identical. They're not experiencing we don't give them mitochondrial stress at all. They're just normally growing. But if we look at them, we can see, you know, 5 to 10% of them that actually turn that on. And the 95% haven't. If we take that 5 or 10%, they actually end up being long-lived naturally. We didn't do anything to them. And so maybe, you know, if you can stochastically turn on the stress responses at some time in your life, maybe that's a better predictor for you being long-lived. I don't know. I mean, it's an idea that's out there. It doesn't explain all of the curve. It explains the last part of the curve, the long-lived part. I can't explain the first, you know, the short-lived part. Maybe those animals can't turn on the response.
I see. So in animals where you've increased their longevity, you cause them to live longer. It's been done in multiple organisms, a few different ways that you've talked about. You said something that kind of triggered me earlier. Are they reaching the same developmental milestones at the same time, or is their development like delayed itself? Are they becoming mature later?
Well, so we can look at their early developmental stages up to, you know, we classify them as adults. Mm-hmm. You know, we rigorously identify them as just entering adulthood, and that's when they start their lifespan. So we're only looking at adult lifespan.
I see.
We're not looking at developmental, but are there stages in adulthood that we're not identifying? You know, are there gradations of adulthood that we're not identifying that's possible? You know, one of the major ones we look at is reproductive timing. Like, how long are they reproductive for? And, you know, the IGF-1 mutants extend reproduction. Mitochondrial mutants extend reproduction. So maybe they are extending some parts of development in adulthood.
I see. Okay. So they have a longer reproductively viable window. They're not reaching maturity necessarily at a different time.
Exactly. Exactly. And that explains why these would never be selected for in nature, is that it's taking them longer to have their full complement of progeny.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they'd probably be predated out before they could do this.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So at a high level, So there's aging is sort of inherently interesting to everyone, because everyone wants to stay young. No one wants to get old. No one wants to die. It's a pretty high profile field, in the sense, at least, that it's getting a lot of attention. There's a lot of really interesting results out there, a lot of really interesting claims. A lot of the claims that people get really excited about have to do with longevity, delaying the aging process, the idea of living forever, or, you know, living a ridiculously long amount of time, at least with a good health span. Do you think the aging process can, so I want to distinguish between lengthening life or lengthening health span by delaying the aging process versus, say, reversing aging. So undoing some of the bad things that happen as we age. To what extent are these longevity effects a delay of the aging process? So, you know, the wear and tear is happening at a slower rate. Things are breaking down at a slower rate, versus how much of it is actually coming from reversing things that have already been done?
Well, I mean, I don't believe in any of the reversal stuff. I don't think that there's any basis for that, scientific basis for that. But the delaying parts, I mean, that is clear. I mean, that's clear in model organisms. Let's qualify all this. You know, we're talking non-humans. I think one of the most classic experiments that we did early on in my career is, let's talk about Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease, let's agree that it's caused by the formation of A-beta plaques. And, you know, we can, of course, argue about other causes, but let's just say that that is the milestone that, you know, if you get A-beta plaques, you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. And the argument that, you know, you get it late in life is that it just takes time to make those A-beta plaques, enough of those to actually cause pathology. So if you take a long-lived animal and a normal-lived animal, and you engineer them both to produce the A-beta producing plaques, and they produce it the same way, then they should both get Alzheimer's disease at exactly the same time, because it's just a matter of time, right? It's thermodynamics, if that is the argument. But what we did is we took the IGF-1 mutant mice that are long-lived compared to the littermates that are normal-lived, engineered them to have Alzheimer's disease. The IGF-1 long-lived mice didn't start getting symptoms until all the control mice were dead. So they, you know, the same amount of time happened. They were producing the exact same amount of A beta, but thermodynamically, the IGF-1 mice took care of it and dealt with it like they were young, right? You don't hear about young people really, unless it's catastrophic, getting Alzheimer's disease.
I guess,
There's some age component that happens.
yeah, and I don't know enough about the Alzheimer's field to know how to think about this part of the question, but everything you just said makes sense, but it's all predicated on the A-beta plaques being the causal factor here.
Course.
Is that the general consensus, or is that an X factor still?
I mean, it's more, you know, tau is a major driver of this that was not in our experiments. Also, you know, what we uncovered is that the oligomers were really the toxic species, and that was driving the pathology. And that's really what people believe now about A beta. But not even thinking about the disease, just thinking about thermodynamics, you know, forming these aggregates, if it was just a thermodynamic process, both of these animals should have formed them at the exact same rate, and they didn't. So there's something inherent about being young that can delay. I mean, they eventually did form them, and once they formed them, they did the same pathology as a wild type. But something about being young and youthful, you are delaying these events from happening. Now, could you actually go and reprogram this in an older animal and make them reverse those plaques? I highly doubt it. I think you have to be, you know, in the formation process in the early stages of these types of diseases to delay them happening.
So there's a lot of experimental manipulations that you guys can engineer that extend healthspan and lifespan. So you can go in and manipulate genes and things like that. Setting those things aside and just thinking about what we'll just call lifestyle factors. So things that can vary from an individual to an individual in a population that aren't artificial in the experimental sense. You know, so you can two animals can have very different diets. One can eat more, one can eat less. One can eat one thing, one can eat another thing. Another could be activity levels or exercise. One could run around more than the other one. What sort of lifestyle factors are most robustly tied to increases in longevity? Is it caloric restriction?
That's it. So we can start with calorie restriction. So there's a huge misnomer here, you know, especially by researchers, that calorie restriction is universal. I mean, yes, of course, it's been tested in many different organisms. It extends lifespan, blah, 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 blah. But when you take calorie restriction across, you know, different strains of mice that are not even nearly representing the heterogeneity in the human population, you know, Rich Miller did these studies, and you know, 20% of those strains live long, 20% actually live short.
I see. So some strains of mice, if you calorically restrict them, do live longer, but an equal number of strains with a different genetic background will actually, you'll see the opposite result with the same
Yeah,
level of caloric restriction.
absolutely. And then the others have no effect whatsoever. And the thing about calorie restriction is we talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, it's this bell-shaped curve. And that there's a sweet spot, you know, too much calorie restriction, you're starvation, too little, you're actually overfeeding. And there's like this sweet spot right in the middle. And we all have a different set point for that sweet spot. And if you're shifted to the right a little bit and you take the same sweet spot drug that everyone else has, you're actually going to end up dying because you're on the starvation. side of things. And if you're left shifted, you're going to feel no effect. So I think that we have to be super cautious about aging and interventions of aging and applying them to whole populations. I mean, I'm all for the basic biology. You know, aging has been phenomenal for me because I've uncovered new areas of biology. And that's where I think aging has its greatest strengths, is finding new areas of biology. But trying to actually say we're going to therapeutically change it, that may be possible in a very restricted fashion. I think it's going to be even more personalized than cancer medications or other types of diseases that are extremely personalized now. Aging, I think, is going to be even more personalized, especially when you start dealing with nutrient sensing pathways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, that makes a lot of sense. I was just say that makes a lot of sense. A lot of these results come from single inbred strains of mice, and it's easy to forget that.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, you know, there's been populations of people that, you know, that lived in certain parts of the world, and all of a sudden they get a Western diet. And, you know, you and I can adapt to a Western diet, but then all of a sudden they're like 300 pounds because their set point's completely different.
Yeah. I mean, even my last episode was with S.K. Villerslev, who's a evolutionary biologist who studies basically human evolutionary genetics in the past few thousand years. Even if you're talking about white Europeans, there's an incredible amount of genetic variation in fatty acid metabolism, the ability to tolerate carbohydrates, that, you know, even within that, you know, small segment of the human population, you would expect them to see very different responses to caloric restriction or different dietary compositions.
Yes. I fully expect it. And the hard part that we're having is that there's this wave of, you know, diet drugs, Ozempic, these things, as well as metformin. You know, metformin is being touted as an anti-aging drug, which it does some of those things in model organisms, but really its effects are on diabetes and obesity, right? You're already at the extreme. And so you're dialing this back to more normal. And I think that now healthy people will start taking that, but where are they actually on that extreme? They're already normal. So is this actually going to push them, you know, to the other side that may actually be detrimental?
Right.
So I'm, you know, I'm really worried about this. It may not be any issue. You know, my hope is, you know, metformin has been taken by millions of people. It's pretty safe. It does have some serious side effects, you know, that people do talk about, but, you know, I think it's, where are you on this spectra?
Right. So I think what you're saying is, you know, the Ozempics and these GLP drugs that are out there, they're becoming very popular very quickly because they do seem to be effective at helping people lose weight. What you are basically saying is we might want to be cautious because it might be a good thing if you're clearly obese to be on one of these drugs to help you lose weight. But if you're sort of a normal person and you just want to be skinnier, that could be problematic, and there definitely are people using it who aren't morbidly obese.
No, absolutely. I mean, Ozempic, I don't know if there's a, but metformin is being touted this way. And I, you know, I have colleagues that are totally healthy, not diabetic, taking metformin.
Because they think it's going to have a longevity benefit based on animals.
Because it's going to have a longevity benefit. I mean, they lost, you know, they lost about 10% of their weight, even though they were not overweight. And, you know, they're thinking that they're going to live longer. And I'm like, well, I hope I don't know where you're at, where your set point is.
Yeah.
You know, if you're obese, we know where your set point is. It needs to go down. So of course, you're diabetic. Yes, we need to bring you down. But when you're a healthy person and you're taking something that you won't know the results for another 30 or 40 years, that really, I don't really know how to take that. You are really betting on some early stage science. You know, the aging field, you know, the molecular aging field is not very old. And, you know, we're just now getting sophisticated. And I'm really worried about some of the claims that are being made and, you know, what people are trying to do.
Yeah, interesting. So, you know, a lot of the key networks that are important for aging and other things, you know, you've mentioned things like IGF, mTOR, insulin receptor, you know, we can, I don't know what the best way to start thinking about all these things are, but they're sort of very important nodes in the regulation of energy metabolism, how much we're building up versus breaking down tissue. when we think about something like insulin resistance, so I understand why insulin resistance happens. So the cells, there's too much insulin for too long. The cell wants to decrease its sensitivity to it. I understand why insulin resistance then leads to a decrease in the ability to regulate blood sugar levels. What actually happens after that that causes damage? So like when a cell is insulin resistant for a long time, what goes wrong downstream?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got to have a complete metabolic rewiring, right? Because it's not, if you become insulin resistant, you're not going to be taking in glucose. So you're changing your energy sources. I mean, I'm not a diabetologist and I don't study insulin that much, but I think that you're definitely changing your metabolic demands in that tissue that normally relies upon insulin to get its glucose in. So you're having to change what energy sources it's using. And if it's a cell that can't adapt to that, that sounds really bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't speak more authoritatively on that because it's not really my area.
Mm-hmm. One final thing, if this is something you do know about, it's just a general thing that's been in my mind for at least the last couple of weeks. So let's say you're talking about a healthy individual, healthy animal, normal mitochondrial function. It's eating a good diet, whatever exactly that means. Are the mitochondria going to be preferentially using glucose versus ketones, or do they like to have a certain mix of those things? Do we know very much about that?
I think it depends on which environment that cell is in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, its oxygen demands are going to greatly determine that. How much oxygen is available, of how it's actually going to do glycolysis versus oxidative phosphorylation. I think that's going to be the major drivers of that. And beyond that, I'm trying to think here for a minute. If there's any predictors of this, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is there a right answer? Did I fail the test?
No. I generally don't know. You know, I mean, yeah. I don't know enough to know how much I don't know. but you see, there's a lot of stuff out there where people say, you know, our cells prefer to use glucose over ketones. I've had other people tell me that if you supply your cells with everything they could want, they actually prefer a particular mix of glucose and ketones. And then, you know, the ratio there shifts depending on, you know, what you feed the cells. And so I'm just trying to get a better handle on that. The other thing that you probably do know something about is, given how mitochondria work and given the role of oxygen in the electron transport chain, I imagine they're very sensitive to oxygen concentrations. And I'm wondering what the relationship, so this will just be a vague question. What's the relationship between like overall mitochondrial health and oxygen levels in the environment? So if I go to Denver tomorrow, what's going to start to happen to my mitochondria?
Your mitochondria are going to be fine. I mean, the first thing that your body does is change bisphosphoglycerate levels to change oxygen binding to heme. So that's going to, your mitochondria are going to be fine. They're not going to be affected by the oxygen levels. The only time, so if you have a mitochondrial disease, then you start to become sensitive to oxygen levels. Mm. And there's this beautiful study, Isha Jain, who's at UCSF, when she was with Vamsi Mutha, they're working on a mitochondrial disease, complex Lee syndrome disease. And what people normally wanted to do is they're like, oh, your mitochondria aren't functioning well. We need to give you more oxygen to help your electron transport chain function better so you produce more ATP and alleviate symptoms. And what they uncovered, so there's not really much help in giving high oxygen. It actually may be slightly detrimental. And through a series of screens, they uncovered that oxygen sensing was central to this, and they did the reverse experiment, and they actually put these mice under hypoxia. Hmm. So lower oxygen, you know, it's sort of the layer, the, you know, being in the lower Himalayas. And now these mice were like totally fine. Hmm. Like the mitochondrial disease was gone. Hmm. And they don't know the mechanism yet of what's happening. It's probably maybe turning on this stress response.
Yeah.
To help these mitochondria deal with that mutation in the mitochondrial in their electron transport chain, coupled with lower oxygen, that may be turning this thing off. But the fascinating thing is, you know, they're saying, okay, this could, you know, this be maybe a therapy for, you know, people with Leigh syndrome, is have them live in bubbles, you know, with lower oxygen. But the second you take them out of the low oxygen, the animals can't adapt back and they die.
So that's still,
yeah, it's like you're stuck there. I mean, it's not immediate, you know, it takes a couple of days to die, but they can't register back to being sick. They go from, you know, being sick, going in low oxygen, being well, coming out of low oxygen, not being sick, being dead. You're like, and it's like fascinating. So there is, you know, the oxygen tension sensing with mitochondria is important, but I think, I mean, you're not going to feel it going to Denver. I mean, if you went hiking in the Himalayas and stuff, you're definitely going to go hypoxic. Your mitochondria are probably going to fizz. They're not going to be happy. Denver will probably be all right. But if you have a mitochondrial disease, you know, I think you're more sensitive to these oxygen fluctuations.
What? So you may or may not have a particular answer to this, but I think it's a fascinating pattern. And I'm interested to hear your take, given your background as a biologist. So when you think about obesity, one of the most striking graphs I've seen is basically an overlay of obesity rates in the continental United States with a topology map showing altitude. And there's this shocking correlation where you just see obesity rates go way down as you go up in altitude. So for some reason, Colorado has way lower obesity rates than almost anywhere else in the continental United States. What do you think could be going on there? Does this have something to do with oxygen? Does it have something to do with mitochondrial biology and just overall metabolic rate?
I think it's lifestyle. I mean, when you go to Colorado this weekend, go and climb four flights of stairs and see how you feel. I think it's just a lifestyle thing, is that, you know, put on 40 pounds of extra baggage on you and climb up and down four flights of stairs. You know, I don't know where you're located. If you're at sea level, it's going to be very different than at, you know, 5,000 feet.
So you're basically saying that the lower oxygen environment is analogous to me walking around literally with a 40-pound backpack here or something like that. I have to work harder to do the same behavior.
Oh, you're going to have to work harder in Colorado, right?
Yeah.
And I just think that that's a selection process, is that if you're obese, you're not going to want to live in Colorado. And
I see. So you don't think, it might not be that the environment is causing this pattern to emerge. It might be that people are sorting themselves.
I think people are sorting themselves out. Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely sorting themselves. I mean, it's such a loaded question because, you know, there's so many outdoor activities in Colorado. You know, people are super active there. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a social stigmatism to be obese probably in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And so fewer obese people want to stay there. Also, you're like, man, it's so hard for me to walk up the stairs because it's lower oxygen. So I'll just, you know, go to lower elevations. I don't know.
I see.
That's an interesting, I don't think it's there. I mean, there's underlying biology, but I think there's more psychology happening.
Okay. Interesting. well, we've already covered a lot. I don't necessarily want to dig into a whole new topic and take up too much of your time. Thank you for this. It's been fascinating. Is there anything that you want to reiterate from what we discussed, or any final thoughts about this general area of science you want to leave people with?
No, I mean, if there's, you know, future scientists that are listening to this, I mean, there's so many things that are uncovered, and our lab is a prime example. I never thought I'd be working on mitochondria, never thought I'd be working as a neuroscientist. So it's truly fascinating, you know, to see what's out there. And there's so many other things happening. And, you know, this whole idea of aging, it's early days. It is really early days, and it's going to be super personalized. You know, that's my personal feeling, but exercise, sleep well, try to eat as best you can. I think those are the only things we can't control.
All right, Professor Andy Dillon, thanks again for your time.
Thanks so much, Nick. Take care.